Welcome to Beyond the Document, the podcast from Formpipe, where we discuss everything that is output, document, and customer communication management. In this episode, we're joined by Leda Glyptis, who's a well-known and respected voice within the banking industry, and she is author of Bankers Like Us. So welcome to the podcast, Leda.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get into the book, one thing I wanted to pick up on is before we do a podcast, I always look on LinkedIn and you define yourself as a client first executive. And I think this is quite timely because within the banking industry, we're all talking about the need for client centric focus. So can you just give a brief introduction to yourself and touch upon what you mean by a client first executive?
Of course, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. You know, there are some topics that are so close to our heart that we can now, if we had the chance, we would never shut up about them. And this is one of them. So I'm about 20 years in the industry, as I say in my book, entirely accidentally. I was never dreaming of becoming a banker, but I found myself in an industry that I grew to become very, very emotionally invested in at a time that was very interesting. And during that time, we talked a lot about personalization. We talked a lot about technology as an enabler to do better for our clients. We remain an industry that faces most of its time inwards. And I'm sure we'll get to talk about why we have become so bureaucratic, why organizations, even very small organizations, startups and scale-ups in this industry, why do we spend so much time looking inwards at our own needs and politics, let's call it for what it is, at internal workings, be it governance and process, which is absolutely essential, being out working with investors and stakeholders, which is absolutely essential. But if you do a breakdown of the time spent, and I'm rambling now, but if you do a breakdown of the time spent of any decision maker, any executive in a financial services entity of whatever size, it is disproportionately skewed away from clients.
Yeah, sure.
The clients who pay our bills, who are at the heart of what we do, who are the purpose and mission of the services and products we generate. And actually putting them first, not just in terms of the words, but in terms of priority, decisions, and time spent is not an easy exercise, but it's a vital one. There you go. I'll get off my little soapbox now.
No, please get back on that soapbox. and one thing to make clear, now we're not on video, this is an audio recording, but the book is a hard copy, a hardback, which is a nice thing as well. So I've got my copy next to me here. And within the book, it's there to explore the banking industry and where we are currently. You know, this is an industry in transition. So maybe you can give a couple of minutes overview as to why you went on this journey to write a book and what you're trying to achieve within it.
For those of you who don't know me, if you like my writing, you're in luck. There's about 7 years of back catalogue blogs on banking, technology, now fintech futures. I've been writing about these topics for quite a few years now. And if I'm honest, I started writing as therapy. You know, I would have a long, often frustrating day, at the end of which I felt that I was always presented with two choices. One was to stay frustrated and angry, go down the pub with the rest of the team and go, oh my God, or actually process what had happened, what had not happened, what made it frustrating. And in the processing, stories always emerge because there are patterns in the things we do and don't do. So if I look back at what has made me a familiar voice in the industry, it has mostly been a way of trying to work through my own frustration in a way that felt constructive, because it's very easy to become disillusioned about an organization's or an industry's ability to change. But where does that take us? So if I look back at those 7 years of writing and at the last 15, 20 years of working in transformation functions and banking, that's a bloody long time to be in transition and not making much progress. So the book was a distillation of these observations, and it came about partly through my readers and the publisher, Tanya Andresian, publisher of my column, saying, okay, it's time now. It's time for long form. Your people want long form. But it was also a frustration with all of us around the table. You can't be transitioning for 15 years and not moving forward, right? We're doing something wrong. So the book is a look back to look ahead. We've been doing it for 15 years, this digital transformation. We can agree it's not working very well because we wouldn't still be wondering what the options are. When you look around you, you're in a fully digital economy and financial services entities are still on, you know, mainframes. So we're doing something wrong. And the book is, these are the things I've learned over the last 20 years about what we're doing wrong and where we're getting in our own way and how we might want to stop.
And I wasn't aware that that was the reason that you started writing, but as I'm a father to teenage girls and I encourage them to journal when they've had maybe a challenging day. And that's a different type of transition.
Oh, brilliant. Well, yeah, but it's the same mechanics, right? I always think that, I used to do yoga many years ago and my instructor always said, whatever happened with your day today, leave it on the mat. I never managed that as well as I've managed the leave it on the page. But I always found that it's a process that allows me to emerge with a positive, constructive attitude. I'm one of those people who are not very good at carrying negativity. It really weighs me down. I need that Pollyanna approach to the world. We are going to make things better. And sometimes it's hard. So actually writing about it was my way of finding my way back to the light.
Yeah. And like you say, you know, every now and then going down the pub helps, but you can't be doing that too regularly. You've got to have a more positive way.
You know, considering how frustrating our days can be, you'd be there three times a day. That's not very good.
So back to the book again. And I know at Formpipe, we work with some Greenfield banks and they have the luxury of being able to build their organization from, you know, the ground up. But the majority do have existing operations. They have BAU responsibilities. You've just touched on some of the age of the technology they'll have to support that. So in your book, you do ask that question of why do we make it so hard and whether that be human, structural, you've touched on governance or maybe just perceived challenges that we see in our way. So can you explore that area of the book, please?
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right that the problems I describe are very often perceived as being pertaining to legacy organizations. And largely they are more noticeable in legacy organizations. But before I go down the path of answering your question, I want to point out that technology moving as fast as it does, any organization has legacy within 3 years. Some cases, even less. Technology moves so quickly that you'll find that some of the tech choices you made were superseded by how quickly technology moves. Some of the tech choices you made were too ambitious for what you need, and now you have a heavy footprint that you don't need, or not ambitious enough, same problem. Or you might find that your strategy moved a little bit or your clients need. So legacy is not something that is only plaguing an organization that is 30 years old. I would say any entity that is over 3 years old will have some legacy constraints. Equally, any organization and any techie on the call, I challenge you to disagree. Any organization, no matter how smart you are, will have technical debt within 18 months. By definition, someone will go, we'll deal with that later, or we'll neglect documentation. So the problems that we're discussing are not the domain of just big organizations or old organizations, although they're more pronounced there. And I think it is important that startups, scale-ups, or digital native firms don't brush their shoulders going, pooh, that doesn't concern me. It absolutely does.
Is there a degree leader there where we shouldn't also get hung up on almost the negative connotation of legacy? It's not somebody's fault. Like you're saying that it can be due to multiple different factors, but it has occurred.
100%.
Yeah, okay.
It is no one's fault. It will be due to 100 factors, some of which I will discuss in a second. The other thing is that if you have legacy of a bad kind, so complicated systems, you always neglect to say that you have legacy of a good kind. You've been in business for a while, you have customers, you have money, you have assets. So legacy is only acquired by the privilege of having survived as a business. You know, I have a friend who always says getting old is the biggest privilege not reserved for everyone.
Yep.
So you can get hung up on having whatever ails come with old age, but isn't that better than the alternative? So you're absolutely right. Legacy isn't all bad. And it comes with having survived, so you're doing something right. But the things that lead to legacy are human nature above and beyond everything else. And so everyone is susceptible to them. The first one is habits, and I talk about it a lot in the book. A very large percentage of what we do every day is habitual. You leave your keys in the same place. If they're not there, you're going to go spare in the morning looking for them. There are reasons why the human brain is wired to defaulting to habit, and they're both medically and sort of from a personal preference always there. But I think habits are huge. Habits become why we do things a certain way. People are trained in a particular way and they default to that training. Organizations have muscle memory, and it takes huge effort to break that. I did a workshop for an executive team. I do those occasionally. I did this executive team workshop, and it was all about how they can take everything we talk about in my book and in conferences about technology changes, take everything we know about organizational constraints and apply it to some practical steps on how they can make vendor selections for technology differently. And it was actually a very, very clever way of asking the questions, because it was weaving the themes together, and it was saying, okay, like in practical terms, where do we need to apply pressure to make changes? So we were a few weeks in planning, really, really insightful leadership in asking for this workshop. I loved putting it together. Nobody gave procurement the memo. The amount of old school hoops I had to jump through to be allowed to be present at this event that was talking exactly about the thing that was standing in the way. And why? Nobody was trying to be difficult. Everyone was trying to be helpful. But in being helpful, it didn't occur to any of them that they could change the rules. And in fact, they should change the rules. We went for a variety of workarounds of such complexity that you cannot believe, which brings me to the second thing that I took back.
We've touched on this internally as well around procurement as well. I do think that's a part of the industry we could really drastically help, because the procurement departments are there to do a good job, right? They're there to make sure that the organization are buying in the correct way, but they're not experts of the market, and they don't really understand the different vendors. I think that's where there's a bit of a gap as well. They can't be expected to.
They don't understand the vendors. You're absolutely right. I think risk matrices. So you can help your procurement by providing them with a different face into risk and compliance. If a procurement team has to prove that an entity has been in business for 10 years before they're considered safe to do business with, you'll never do business with a startup. They can't change that, but risk and compliance can. The second thing that you can change with procurement, and I talk about it at some length in the book, is how you do vendor selection. If you stop doing RFPs and start doing competitive POCs, you take away the paperwork, you take away the delay, and you also take away the knowledge gaps, because a competitive POC is the best and accelerated form of learning. So, but a procurement team can't change that on their own. They need help from senior management. And I think that points out to the second thing I was going to say, which is learned helplessness. There is nothing inside an organization that can't be changed. And yet you have people who are in very, very senior positions throwing their arms up in the air and going, I can't. Procurement won't let me. And it's like, you're the CEO. Procurement is there to guide you on how to do things properly. I remember I worked for a very large bank many years ago, and we were trying to do something. And I was in my idealistic phase. Now I would approach things very differently. But I, at the time, I believed that it was a linear path would get us there fastest. Now I know that's not the truth, right? But at the time, I believed it. And I had worked my way to the president of the bank. I was very junior. I shouldn't have made it there. But sometimes you ask, you get, right? So I had made it there. I had pitched her my idea. And she said, that's brilliant. And we should absolutely do this. But I don't have people to do it. I was like, we need like two people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't have them. It's like, how can you not have them? Everyone works for you. It's not like I'm talking to someone who has a division of five people and they're all flat out. Everyone works for you. So I don't have people can't be the excuse. And she was not giving me an excuse, because actually we found a way of doing it with a consultant, which was more expensive. It was that learned helplessness of, I don't know how to find capacity in my organization. And rather than solving the problem of finding capacity in a lasting way, so that every time I have something to do, I can do it within my organization and retain knowledge and have all the upside, I will go for a band-aid solution right here, right now, and find something that's quicker but doesn't solve the problem. Similarly, every bank I've ever worked in before I moved over to the core banking side of the world would approve or delay innovation programs on the basis of what their core banking capability could sustain, could support. And I remember sitting with our board a couple of times in the past saying, we have said no to these 10 initiatives with a cumulative upside of billions of dollars. Cumulatively, aren't they reason enough to overhaul our core? Oh yeah, but that's how not how we make that decision. Why not? There is a learned helplessness, and everyone knows the answer, but somehow the organizational inertia doesn't allow you to put the information together in a way that stops the train.
But no matter the size of the organization, how efficient or how quickly they're moving, it still comes down to human beings. Yeah, because that's all organizations are. It's a collection of people, isn't it? With some documented processes wrapped around them. And we do see this. And, you know, we try to operate with the best vision in mind for the company all the time. But sometimes I think people do restrict by those perceived barriers that aren't actually there, but it's probably within their own psyche that they're just thinking, we can't do that, or I can't do that, or that's too big a challenge for me today.
Exactly. 100%.
Brilliant. Well, the other thread that runs throughout the book as well that you touch upon is that in most banks nowadays, most people haven't come from a banking background. And I flick this back to Formpipe ourselves, okay, because we're there and we're often tasked with creating the document or the communication that goes out, which is the image of the bank. It's the brand that the customer is seeing. So I get that we're at the sharp end of core banking platforms. And then I thought about this from my own position. Although I was educated at university in financial services, actually the majority of my working career has been in software, both in banking and other regulated industries. So I'm probably more on the compliance and technical side than I am true finance side. So getting into your organization, either by your own staff or through your vendors who you select to be part of your organization, you get in that non-banking input, which from reading your book, I believe is critical. Would you agree with that?
100%. I agree with that 100%, but I also want to caution that the reverse is also true.
Okay, yeah.
So when I started in banking, we were all bankers. There were no non-bankers around. And I remember fighting tooth and nail to bring an engineer in my team that wasn't a banker. And he brought something invaluable, the view from nowhere, right? You can call it whatever you want, but because things were new to him, he could ask questions like, why the hell do we do it that way? And he asked those searching questions that a child asks you sometimes that force you to reflect on which of the parts are essential and which were just our way of doing things, which when you're too closely aligned to the work, too close to the work, too used to it, you don't see. And also imagine new ways of achieving the same outcome. You can't get that fresh look if you're lacking diversity in your thinking, right? The flip side is also true, though. I worked a while ago with a very talented team of engineers providing a solution in the financial services space, and their lack of banking knowledge was a little bit infuriating. So you can't design a solution for a problem you don't understand. So when you come in and say, here's your new core banking system, I expect you to know the answer to questions like, I don't know, how does Treasury behave? Whether you have a solution included in your system or not, different, right? So you need that combination in each and every team of knowledge of the problem you're solving, of the regulatory componentry, extremely important, and of the thing you're moving away from. You need to understand the opaque art of what banks are doing today. Otherwise, you might miss something important. Equally, you need that freshness. People who have done things in an industry where margin for error is much, much less palatable. I had an aeronautics engineer join a team I was in years ago, and he was like, 5% error. Do you know how many people would die if aviation had that? So margin for error, speed, what is acceptable by way of fast service for someone who works for Netflix today is very different to someone who works in a bank. So those higher standards, different codes of practice combined with deep domain knowledge is what you need. You cannot index for one and not the other.
And I see that. I mean, I've often been the one who's put my hand up and said, this might be a stupid question, but why? And often you find there's other people in that room who want to ask the same one. Now, I get you. You need the domain knowledge. You can't be moving into an area where you don't understand the landscape or even the regulatory pressures on an organization. But to be a little bit inquisitive and just say, well, why? You know, that is, it's a skill that not everybody has, I think. And it's a good one to have in your business.
100%.
Okay. Tribe, you talk about your tribe, and anybody who will read this book will love that, because you can sense the passion in the words that you've written on the page. Okay. Now, you talk about your tribe, and I think it's beautiful when you thank your tribe as well. But then you also encourage us all to find our own tribe. Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit and say, why can't we all be united and have one tribe? But could this industry all be moving in the same direction and be one single tribe? Or is that a little bit too far-fetched?
I would love to be able to say yes to you, that we absolutely could. And maybe on some levels and in some topics we could, but the reality is we're all very different people. I think being honest about the things that are important to us, at least to ourselves, helps both with the frustrations of the day and with working out what to do and what not to do and how to do it. My experimentation with my tribe starts with the optimists, and I know I tell the story of the optimists in the books, but please indulge me for a second, because it's one of the most beautiful moments of my career, and maybe we'll entice someone to go out and get the book, which works for me. So many years ago when I worked at BNY Mellon, I should take a step back and say BNY was not my first banking job, but it was the first job where I realized that a big bank, a big organization that can come with a lot of sort of foibles and frustrations of big bureaucracies can also have a culture that is amenable to creativity and belonging. And I will say I've worked in a lot of companies, big and small. It had one of the best cultures I've ever worked in, and you can really thrive in it. And it's a testament to that that we actually ended up with the optimists. And the optimists were not a thing. We were a group of people who just knew each other because we were in the same building. Advantages of being in the office, I guess. We didn't work in the same team. We just knew each other because we met in the cafeteria, or we met through mutual friends, or we found ourselves sharing the lift every day, or being on the same train back and to our homes. There was nothing connecting us professionally, but we became friends, and as friends, we'd share our frustrations over coffee or lunch. And it was a group of people that had two characteristics that I have learned to value immensely. They were unafraid to ask for help. They didn't care whether they would look silly. They didn't need to be the big I am. They'd be like, I don't know how to do this. I'm really frustrated, or this is complicated. Can you help me? And they were always willing to offer it. They didn't care what was in it for them. They were never too busy for you. And that combination of the humility of asking for help and the willingness to offer it meant that we became a nucleus of people who hung out together and problem solved a lot. And we were busted one day. We were busted. The CTO of the bank was getting coffee at the same time as us and was like, what is happening here? And I thought, this is it, right? I'm in trouble now. But not only were we not in trouble, but the organization found a way of turning us into an employee resource group. But the reality is, to answer your question, when we became an employee resource group with the blessings of the organization, a lot of the people who joined us did it because it was flavor of the month, did it to be seen to be a part of it. They had absolutely no intention of asking for help because they were not the sort of people who like admitting they need help, and they were always too busy to offer it.
Rather than truly sharing those characteristics which brought you together as a tribe. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, fantastic. And I'm aware that of the time that we've got left, but what I also liked about the book was right at the end of the book, and actually physically on the last page, right? You have your call to actions, you have your sign off. Instead of just finishing the book, you do say, right, this is what we now need to do. And you mentioned five. I'm just going to raise two that were really pertinent for myself. The first one is ask hard questions. And I've just written down here, you keep mentioning being honest with ourselves and asking questions. And I know the best sales training I ever had teaches you to ask those questions that really you don't want to ask because you're scared of the answer that you might get. But without doing that, we don't actually know where we are. And knowing where we are today, I think, is a very important thing when you're asking those questions. And then the second one is when you mentioned that and remind us that we're in a service industry. And at Formpipe, again, we have six values that drive us. Our second one is understand your customer. And I think we're very good at this, but even sometimes we do forget that product do, operations do, and even the commercial team sometimes forget to stand in the shoes of the customer. And I think it's absolutely critical. So maybe you could just touch on those five call to actions that you signed the book off with.
Well, as you saw, every chapter has a bunch of calls to action. And at the end of the book, I tried to summarize them all. I think the main underlying theme of the book is that we are in an industry that has more influence, indirect but fundamental influence, on people's lives than almost any other industry out there. Whether we feel empowered to make decisions that will change society or not, we have that power, we have that influence. So the book is trying to say, look, you're in a position of influence and responsibility. You may not want to rock the boat and lead a revolution, but there are ways you can make your own life better and your sphere of influence better that are not in any way rocking the boat. You can change how your company does procurement. You can change how you manage your time in the course of your day and make it more aligned to your values and to better outcomes without actually, you know, leading a rebellion and getting fired, perhaps. Equally, though, you can look at the technical capabilities we have today and fundamentally drive financial inclusion globally by changing the cost to serve inside your organizations. All of those decisions are in your gift. The way to make them is to be honest with yourself and determine your own appetite. It is okay to say, I don't have the stomach to do all that, but I'll do my own small thing in my own small way. There is nothing shameful in that, provided you get out of the way of other people who might want to do more. That honesty with yourself then leads to being able to always ask the right question, because it's very easy to ask an easy question to answer, but it's not the right question. And for me, the most fundamental question in our business is, banking is, I call it in the book, a so that business. No matter how you look at finance, be it retail, SME financing, or the most complicated versions of investment banking, we are there to enable something else. We are a step in the process of living, commerce, infrastructure, government work. We are always there so that no sentence and no human activity ends with whatever it is you're doing with your bank. If you accept that you're a so that business, the choice is that you're either of service or you're in the way.
Yes. Yeah, that's your point. Yes. Yeah.
So which is it? Are you of service? Or are you in the way? And it goes full circle to what we were saying at the beginning. If you spend 80% of your time facing inwards in your organization, managing your politics, satisfying your protocols, going to 38 million meetings because your seniors don't want to read reports, then you're in the way.
I completely agree. Lita, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. I just need to ask you one last thing, which I've been so excited to ask. Where can we get the book? Where can we find it?
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you and talking about the book. The book is available on Amazon, and it is also available on the Routledge website under Bankers Like Us.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Lita, thank you again. And I hope to see lots of people within our industry and wider, further afield reading the book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Document. And thank you again to Lita Glyptis for joining us today and talking about her book, Bankers Like Us. As we said, you can find the book on Amazon or on the Routledge website. Just search for Bankers Like Us or for Leader Glyptis as the author. I've been Ben Saxton. Catch you next time on Beyond the Document.